Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're chatting with Sean Broderick, a resource analyst over at Weiss Ratings. Sean and us, well, we talk about a wide range of sectors, and in this interview, we're going to focus a bit more on the oil sector, because oil has been on a run. When you consider just how low and negative the oil price got last year, a little over a year ago, and now oil just recently was making a run close to $80 a barrel. Now we are starting to see a little bit of weakness on the back here. Now oil did touch a high of right around, let's say, 77, just short of $77 a barrel, and is now trading about 73, so still at an elevated level. Look, Sean, there's a lot of people that I've chatted with that still think oil is holding up better, well, than they thought. They think that a pullback is due for oil. Where do you stand? What's your outlook for the oil sector?
I don't have any problem with a pullback. I just think that a pullback is an opportunity to load up on the things you wish you bought the first time around. I mean, what triggered this, or the main thing, there's so many things, right? But OPEC Plus had a meeting. The meeting ended without an agreement to raise production because the United Arab Emirates got ticked off because there was a proposal on the table for additional supply of 2 million barrels per day, which would be reached in gradual monthly installments of 400,000 barrels per day. The problem for the United Arab Emirates is very little of that was going to the UAE. And the UAE said, you know what, we're using a certain month from last year as our benchmark. We'd like to use another month because we had much better production then. And so they just couldn't come to an agreement. UAE walked out in a huff. The meeting ended without any agreement whatsoever. And so that's what scares the market, because they think, oh my God, we could have another price war here. I think that's very unlikely for a bunch of reasons. We just saw, by the way, Saudi Arabia raised its prices to like Asia on the oil that it sells to them. So they're obviously not expecting a price war anytime soon either. And they are kind of the central bank of oil. So I believe cooler heads will prevail. They'll have some kind of agreement eventually. It's just they have to go through this theater with the UAE saying, we don't like it, we hate you all, and then they have to woo them back and all that stuff. Also, at the same time, President Biden is leaning on OPEC. According to the White House, administration officials have been engaged with the relevant capitals around the world to urge a compromise solution to get that production increase to move forward. I think that the view out of the White House is going to be that of a brick wall, because the Middle East and Russia do not care what he says. So people who are adding that into the equation, I think that's the wrong thing to put in. And the third thing we have to think about is that the supply squeeze is real, okay? I mean, according to the International Energy Agency, global oil demand is going to rise to pre-pandemic levels by the end of 2022, rising by 5.5 million barrels per day this year and a little over 3 million barrels per day next year. And that's their forecast. The problem is they've been undershooting on every single forecast they've had, and they've been proven wrong. They're wrong on the downside. The demand is actually much higher on the upside every single time. And so that's why we have U.S. crude oil inventories sliding to their lowest since March of last year. What happened March of last year? Oh, I can remember, you know, it was kind of a pandemic started. So the squeeze is real. The squeeze is on. I think it very unlikely that we are going to see huge production from OPEC Plus. I think what we are going to see is kind of a pullback, and a pullback you can use to lock and load, because if you're like me, you've been taking gains on the way up. Now we get a pullback. Now you get to buy some things again. This is actually going to work out pretty well. So I don't have the view that Wall Street has that this is really bearish for oil, not in the longer term. I mean, well, who knows exactly how far the short-term pullback goes? It's probably not going to be that big a deal, certainly not in the rearview mirror once it's over.
Okay, so you do see some maybe short-term weakness in the oil price, but you're using that as a buying opportunity because it sounds like still bullish in the big picture. where are you going to be looking then in terms of investment opportunities for oil?
Well, one part of the oil complex that has underperformed, and I was just writing a report about this weekend, is oil services, which you can easily track through the XOP. And that's, again, because no one believes that the oil boom is like will have any legs. They all think it's short term, just like they think inflation short term. The market generally believes that the oil boom is short term. They're wrong on both counts, or at least by my view, they are. So the XOP, which is oil services, those stocks have underperformed because for a long time, they really weren't getting the business. However, if you look at the first quarter earnings reports of a bunch of these oil services companies, they're actually quite good, many with upside surprises. We hear about new contracts coming in, stuff like that. We're just about to get to the second quarter earnings reports. Those will start coming out later this month. And I think, again, we could have really good reports within the oil services complex. So I think that's like something people could look at. Like the big oil services ETF, the symbol is XOP. There are other ones you can play if you want a broad energy ETF. I would go with the Vanguard Energy ETF. But, you know, you do you. Whatever you want. People should do their own research. But these are the kind of things that if I'm looking for a way to really position in this, those are the things that I'm really looking at right now. But it's hard to understate how little Wall Street believes in this rally. You can see that by the sell-off we're seeing in the refinery industry right now. Some great stocks being sold off hard because they think, okay, you know, that's it for oil. That's it for gasoline. Meanwhile, the Friday before the 4th of July, we saw like the highest gasoline sales in the U.S. in a dog's age. And it's not just the economy in the U.S. that's coming back rip-roaring. It's around the world. We are seeing a global economic resurgence. That means more oil demand. Not everybody's bought an electric car yet, and they won't for decades. So really, I just see this whole industry is like undervalued, and there are certain segments of it that are really, really attractive.
Well, Sean, those are some interesting comments on the oil sector and the oil services sector. And I think you make a good point that it widely is not trusted that this rally is going to hold, and many oil analysts and many generalists are expecting a pullback. They think that this run is transitory. And you mentioned in passing that they also are saying the same thing about inflation, that, you know, hey, we've seen the top of this now. Many of the generalists we talk to think that inflation really will be transitory. This is it. It was just the base effect. It was just some supply constraints on the market, like the semiconductors for the car market as an example. And they think that now we're going to see things taper back down. So what would your response be to people that are, I know what your response is for the oil, but what's your response on inflation? Is it just going to be transitory, or do you see a case for a bigger inflation on the medium to longer term?
Well, actually, I have a very public comment on that, which is at my WealthWave site. That's wealth-wave.com. It's free. You can go read the column that I put up there Saturday, and that's on inflation. And basically, the Fed says that they think it's, you know, very transitory, and they are full of manure. I mean, I have a bunch of great charts on this. People can look at them. And I'm just looking at these charts, and I realized that they didn't put the credit line that I wanted on the first chart. I swear to God, sometime I'm just going to go off and raise goats on a farm.
Pull it together.
Anyway, there are many ways to measure inflation. People know that. And of course, the Fed has its own individual thing. But one thing is, like, no matter what the inflation is, they like to split into flexible and then sticky. And so flexible are things that can really fluctuate a lot. Gasoline, cars, food, shoes. Sticky is things like car insurance, alcohol, restaurant food, medical care. Those things, once they go up, they really go up. And if you look at it, right now, we are seeing stunning moves in both things, not just in the flexible stuff, but in the sticky stuff as well. I mean, sticky core CPI jumped 4.3% in May. That's the fastest rate in 25 years. This is a wake-up call for Wall Street, and they keep hitting the snooze button. It's just nuts. And I also have a chart on gasoline prices. No surprise, you know. I mean, the price of gasoline is its highest level since 2014, so way beyond the the like pre-pandemic highs. And last one is, of course, home prices. You know, we just saw the biggest gain in home prices since 2005. And so people may say, well, I'm cherry picking what I'm looking at. Well, sure, I am picking a few things, but these articles can only be so long. There's a long, long list of things that have gone up, which are really going to change the like whole face of how we look at what things cost. And I think people have to wake up and just pay attention to this. The last chart I have on there is the inflation on goods from like overseas. And annualized, the most recent data point we have on that is 11.3%. That's what's happened to the goods we're importing from China and elsewhere. It's not like China wants to raise its prices. It wants to be the low-cost producer. It is competing with places like Vietnam and Thailand and you name it. But it has to. At some point, they're forced to pass along the cost of rising inputs, things like copper, steel, aluminum, energy, and more. And so, you know, I mean, in some ways, this isn't bad. It's good to have growth. It's good to have a resurgent economy. It's good to have jobs. So I'm not complaining about that whatsoever. I just wish that the government would wake up and just admit what's going on with the inflation numbers. And so we might have to make some adjustments on that side.
Yeah, Sean, you're dead on there with the different ways to calculate inflation and how some is sticky, some is non-sticky, whether it's core or, you know, or not core. Should we include energy and food? Should we not? I mean, the overall trend is prices are going up in almost everything. And part of that's the reopening trade and part of that's been the supply issues. But you tying it all together with the beginning of this interview, obviously, energy is one of the biggest input costs in everything, whether it's freight and shipping or, you know, getting products to the end users. It does hurt expendable income for consumers, so that's always the deflationary argument. But for the most part, it's an inflationary force to have energy costs higher like they are. I mean, if we look at oil, it's doubled, basically, in less than a year. I mean, actually, it's more than that if you count it being negative last year, but that was an anomaly. So the energy cost being a factor and all prices, no matter how you calculate it, prices are going up. So how do you see the energy equation fitting in with the inflation equation for the longer term?
Well, one thing we have to remember is that the last time, well, the big oil crisis everyone talks about in the 1970s, we were importing so much oil. Now we export oil. Now we actually produce so much oil here in the U.S. And so those places that produce oil are going to see a continuing economic boom, right? I mean, places like Texas, Oklahoma, the Dakotas, you name it. There's some places in America where we are going to see a boom continue and probably get hotter. And that, by definition, is inflationary. It's not just prices on the goods we import from China that are going to go up. It's the price of stuff we sell and make. And so everyone gets paid more. And so inflation just kind of snowballs that way. So I see, you know, as I said, in some ways it's good because we all want people to have jobs and we all want people to have more money and all that stuff. But we just have to change our concept. Because for so long, it seemed inflation was dead. And people have a real hard time changing that mindset. I think the sooner they shake that mindset and they adjust their portfolios for inflationary times, the happier they'll be.
Sean, how do you see the balance between inflationary times in terms of goods and the actual potential data reflecting higher inflation compared to what we had seen over the last decade, where it seemed to be more market inflation? Money was simply going into the markets and they just kept moving higher. It was almost a different form of inflation on the back of a lot of money printing.
Yeah, well, I had another article on this a few weeks ago, which is during an inflationary environment, generally value stocks outperform growth stocks. It's a weird thing, but basically when there's inflation around, people want return on their money now. And what gives you return on your money now is a stock that pays nice dividends and keeps raising those dividends. So value stocks tend to outperform. So the names that led when all the prices were flat for decades, and those are basically growth stocks, basically tech, because those are the companies that could really give you big returns, you know, on your investment. Well, they might underperform compared to some old so-called boring value names that will become more attractive to investors as we go forward. That's my outlook. That's the way I'm kind of positioning things. So I am talking my own book, but that's actually something I really believe. So I'm just trying to help out my subscribers this way.
What about gold? Is it still an inflation hedge, Sean?
It is, however, I keep having to refer to reports and articles I've written, but it's not the best inflation hedge. That's the funny thing. I mean, it's a great inflation hedge, but there are things that outperform gold in an inflationary environment. One is energy, which is one of the reasons that I'm so excited about energy. The other is copper and industrial metals, because these are things that you can't not use, right? Copper is actually a better inflation hedge than gold is. Most people might not realize that. Silver is probably slightly better than gold. They're both lumped in the precious metals thing, but silver is more of an industrial metal. So keep that in mind as you invest in the metal space. I'm not selling gold. You know, I'm not selling gold miners. I think there's still great opportunities there. And remember, gold usually rises in the second half of the year. So this is the time of year when you want to be looking at those names anyway. And I'm flying out to a gold project in Alaska next week. So it's not like I'm giving up on the gold story, but you should have more things in your basket now. Things like energy, things like industrial metals, they could do very well.
Very good comments, Sean. As always, pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for breaking down oil sector, but then also carrying that over into what inflation looks like for different metals, especially gold. And you are right when it comes to inflation hedging for gold. But look, this whole inflation discussion, a lot of people on the inflation is here to stay bandwagon. There's also a lot of people on the it's transitory bandwagon. So let's see how it plays out. Sean, thanks again for your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, you too.